Good morning and welcome to everyone who is joining us. My name is Paul Bittinger, and I am the medical director for the Region 1 Regional Disaster Health Response System. The RDHRS is a program funded by the United States Department of Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, designed to improve the disaster response capabilities of the healthcare system across the country and improve partnerships among public health, healthcare, emergency management, and others to overall enhance the nation's resilience for medical and other disaster threats. We're really pleased to join you this morning to provide an update on the current treatment options for COVID-19. This webinar is intended for both a medical and non-medical audience. We know that many of you have questions or are looking for ways to summarize how the current changes in treatment interventions as well as available therapeutics are changing the landscape clinically for COVID-19, and we hope in the next hour to be helpful to you in providing this kind of information. Forgive me for starting with a disclaimer, but because we're a federally funded project, I think it's important to note that the content that will be presented in this webinar is on behalf of the individual speakers only and does not in any way reflect the policy or position of any part of the United States government. The content is not, of course, professional medical advice, but is meant to be advisory and helpful to attendees in their planning efforts. And none of the speakers today has any specific affiliation or financial conflicts of interest to disclose. I would like to introduce the five speakers that we have today, and then I will ask Gary Kleinman and Russ Webster to make some opening remarks. But again, I'm Paul Bittinger, and I'm the medical director for the Region 1 RDHRS. Very, very pleased to have Gary Kleinman join us, who is the Regional Administrator for Region 1 for the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, as well as Mr. Russ Webster, who is the Regional Administrator for FEMA Region 1 and is serving as the Region 1 Federal Coordinating Officer for the COVID-19 response. Our two speakers today will be Dr. Catherine Hibbert, who is the medical director of the Medical Intensive Care Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, and Dr. Alyssa Letourneau, who is the director of the Antimicrobial Stewardship Program at the Massachusetts General Hospital within the Division of Infectious Diseases. So very much would like to thank Mr. Kleinman, Mr. Webster for their support of this webinar and for joining us. So Gary, let me turn to you if I may.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning. I'll be very brief. As many of you know, this is not our first webinar in coordination, collaboration with the Massachusetts Region 1 Partnership for Regional Disaster Health Response. They are our go-to source of expertise for situational awareness, for healthcare operations, for clinical care, and the coordination of specialty services. So clearly an obvious choice when Russ and I wanted to ensure that our partners, state, tribal, emergency management, public health, and clinical, have the latest information on the current knowledge and the promising therapies for COVID-19. We faced increasing cases in the fall and winter, so we're delighted to be able to co-sponsor this webinar with them. Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you so much, Gary. Russ?
Thanks very much, Paul, and thanks, Gary. I'm delighted to be here today. I think one of the strongest weapons we have during the COVID crisis has been accurate information. And as we see a trend towards complacency and normalcy bias among the population that has fortunately been unaffected, I think briefings like this that bring both emergency responders and healthcare personnel up to date on the latest information can help shape change those type of things that we can forecast as becoming necessary based on the trends. My earliest example is the conversations that I had with Governor Baker about the number of ventilators required in the early phases of this. And now that the government has 134,000 ventilators in the Strategic National Stockpile, I know that you're all going to tell us today about the medical and healthcare improvements that going that are going to affect that equation and many others in terms of our planning. So I'm very much looking forward to the briefing today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. And definitely thanks so much to both of you for your leadership throughout this pandemic and all of your incredible hard work. The agenda today is that we will be covering three topics. I will start with just an overview of the data regarding where we are with case rates, as well as the changing demographics of infection that we're seeing. Many of you are aware that certainly, of course, case numbers are not headed in the direction that we want, but there are other factors that are changing. It's worth being on the same page about that. And then Dr. Hibbert will start with discussing how clinical care is changing, how that may be affecting outcomes with COVID-19. And then she and Dr. Letourneau will be talking about currently available and some of the anticipated pharmacologic interventions and what they're known or their potential impact is on this current pandemic. So to start with, obviously, unfortunately, I think everyone is aware that the number of cases across the United States is increasing. This is the seven-day average, and we have exceeded the two previous peaks that we have seen here within the United States. And we are approaching our most recent hospitalized peak. As we'll be touching on in the next couple of slides, even though the number of cases in the second peak overall exceeded the number of cases in the first peak, the number of hospitalizations was very similar. The number of hospitalizations per capita per person in the first wave was much higher. That number was lower in the second wave, which had more cases but fewer hospitalizations. And we're seeing that we're approaching that number now with yet more cases, but so far somewhat fewer hospitalizations. If you look at it broken out across the country, those of us that are here in New England right now in Region 1 are very well aware of the fact that our most severe peak, our most severe wave by far, was in that March, April, May time frame. So we had our greatest number of cases in the third week of April, May, somewhere in that range, and then saw a relatively steady decline until the last few weeks where numbers have been rising. Currently, the Northeast makes up about 10% of the U.S. Case volume. Numbers, unfortunately, are rising in all three other regions across the United States, but most notably in the Midwest and in the South, those numbers are substantially increasing and represent the majority of cases currently within the U.S. Deaths, as I think most everyone on this webinar knows, are a lagging variable that well past the peak of infections, past the peak of hospitalizations, comes the trending numbers of deaths. And while we are grateful that there have been fewer deaths overall, we saw a surge in the number of deaths after the second peak, second wave that I showed in the previous slides, as well as, unfortunately, an increasing trend of the number of deaths in the United States now. And this is a slightly more complicated slide, but I think tells the story of why those different graphs that I just showed have different heights. It is not the case that each wave or each graph that represents the number of cases or the number of people in the hospital or the number of people who are dying is proportionate or is of equal height. And I think this will maybe tell you why. That the number of people who tested positive early, you can see in that blue line, was largest there to the left, had the second peak in the middle of the summer, and now is rising again. But the hospitalization rate, despite changing numbers, has actually been lower as a percent of the overall numbers of cases. If you try, and this can be hard to do, to try and tease it out as you look at this graph, but trying to identify where the peak of the blue line is, the gray line is, and the green line, what you'll see is that the percent positive cases is the first indicator, followed a couple weeks later by increases in the hospitalization rate, which is followed a couple of weeks later by increases in the death rate. So the numbers do trend in the same directions, but with a lag between number of positive tests, number of people in the hospital, and number of deaths. And as everyone is well aware, the death and hospitalization rates are very different depending on the decile, the age range within the population. And so if we look between March and the end of October, you can see that the hospitalization rates are by far the highest in the over 65 age range, and decrease as you go down to 50 to 64 or 18 to 49. However, I would point out that those numbers aren't trivial. They're not small, even in the 0 to 17-year-old age range, let alone 18 to 49. So I really want to caution that it's important not to minimize hospitalization rates in any group of the population, but certainly notice that the population above age 65 remains disproportionately at risk. And as I think everyone is also aware, we have clearly seen that the impact on populations has not been equal, and that Black, non-Hispanic, as well as Hispanic populations have been disproportionately affected throughout this pandemic, that continues, unfortunately, to be the case. If you look at age in a different way, you can break out each of the age groups here by a different colored line, and what you'll notice is that the relative heights of these lines is changing. So across the three waves that we've seen so far, that oldest age group, the over 65 age group, which is that blue dashed line, is decreasing in height. What that means is that overall we're seeing fewer older patients who are being hospitalized with COVID over time since the beginning of March. And proportionately or relatively, the younger age ranges are not decreasing to the same degree. So it is true to say that overall hospital rates are decreasing across the population. They are actually decreasing more in the older age range and less so in the younger age range. And what that means is that we are, relatively speaking, hospitalizing a younger patient population currently with the current wave that we're seeing. So to try and translate what that means with changing hospitalization rates, changing death rates, changing age of the population who are needing care, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Catherine Hibbert, who, as I mentioned, is the medical director of the Mass General Medical Intensive Care Unit, to talk about both the clinical and the therapeutic experience.
Thank you so much, Dr. Benninger, and thank you, everybody, for having us on this webinar. It's really nice to have you all join us this morning. I'm sorry we can't see you all. I think that what Dr. Benninger has just highlighted is the urgency with which people want to better understand whether outcomes for these patients are changing. And as we see, you know, spikes in case volume across the country, including here in the Northeast, a very natural question for all of us who are doing preparedness work and preparing to care for these patients is how many will come to our hospital doors, and once they're in our hospitals, how many will be in the ICU, which is the world that I work and live in. You know, how many will need breathing machines, how many are going to be critically ill and potentially die. And I want to highlight on this graph just how broad the range of reported outcomes for critically ill patients is already in COVID-19. So every study here, including two studies out of MGH, came out of the first wave. These are all nearly contemporaneously reported data. And you can see that the range in, these are mortality numbers, the range in percent of patients in the ICU who died is all the way from 15% to more than 80%. And these are all from academic institutions. These are all from, you know, very capable healthcare centers. And the reason that the range is so broad is that there are many, many things that impact mortality and outcomes in these patients. Part of the variation we see here is because of the way that data is reported. For example, many of us saw the Northwell report from New York with that mortality of greater than 80%. That was a reporting error that they actually retracted because the way that they are corrected, the way that they reported mortality was to exclude everybody who had not yet been discharged from the hospital. So they excluded a lot of living patients by doing that. But even excluding that sort of methodological error, there was still a lot of variation in outcomes. And next slide. And what determines outcomes in these patients? It's certainly, as Dr. Binninger highlighted, what are the demographics of the identified cases? Are we seeing younger patients who may be hospitalized but more likely to survive? Are we seeing patients with a lot of comorbidities or elderly patients who are more likely to die of their disease? Local healthcare capacity, you know, are we admitting these patients to hospitals that have a lot of capacity, or are we admitting them to very stressed and strained healthcare systems, as happened to many hospitals in the Northeast during the first wave? What types of hospitals are patients being admitted to, and do they have advanced therapies like ECMO or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation for severe respiratory failure? And then I think part of what Dr. Letourneau and I will talk about is, are there new therapeutic interventions that are beginning to modify outcomes, and how will we know that? And overarching all of these is the issue of access to healthcare and systemic inequity of access to healthcare, as well as systemic barriers of access to healthcare that are going to impact any of these other factors from improving outcomes in the patients that we take care of. Next slide. So we're going to talk, Dr. Letourneau and I will talk about different pharmacologic interventions, but in the absence of different pharmacologic interventions, I think the first question is, what is the standard of care for patients who are critically ill, who have life-threatening illness from COVID-19, and can we improve outcomes by implementing care that we've used for other patients in the past? Next slide. So when patients become critically ill with COVID-19, they almost universally have respiratory failure. They have a severe pneumonia that progresses to something called ARDS, or acute respiratory distress syndrome. This ARDS is characterized by rapid onset with a finding on chest X-ray of bilateral pneumonia that's not fully explained by heart failure. And it's clinically recognized by hypoxemia, where patients have low oxygen levels. Advanced, please. And we know that when we look at patients who have COVID-19 for the clinicians on the line, that their histopathology, if we take a biopsy of their lung either while they're alive or postmortem, it looks very, very similar to how ARDS is classically described in the literature. Advanced, please. And so knowing that these patients almost universally meet the Berlin definition, and knowing that they really resemble these patients with ARDS, we can take what we've previously learned about caring for patients with ARDS and extrapolate it to the COVID-19 population. Next slide. And I'll just show these as some comparison data. So the top two studies, which are in yellow, are patients who have ARDS before COVID emerged. So these are patients where you can see what the compliance or the stiffness of their respiratory system is, and then how severe their impairment in oxygenation is, which is quantified by the PaO2 to FiO2 ratio. And then the bottom three studies are all studies of COVID-19 patients with respiratory failure, and you can see here that the numbers are remarkably similar between the two types of groups of patients. Almost all of them, whether they're COVID or non-COVID, have a similar degree of impairment of oxygenation, and they also have very similar changes in this respiratory system compliance or stiffness of their respiratory system, which is a marker for illness severity. And similarly, although the range of reported mortality that I showed you before is broad, it is also very similar to prior studies of ARDS. And I think all of this together has really convinced us that we should be treating these patients as ARDS patients. Next slide. So if we think about the critical care interventions that many of the clinicians on this line have provided or are familiar with that we offer to people with ARDS, this is probably a whole talk unto itself, but I just want to highlight a couple things. You can see here that on the y-axis you have increasing intensity of intervention, and on the x-axis you have increasing severity of lung injury, again quantified by that impairment in oxygenation. Advance. And the cornerstone or the base of the pyramid for care of these patients is not particularly complicated. And I think this should be very good news to everybody on this line who's doing disaster preparedness and capacity building, which is that what all of these patients should receive is thoughtful ventilator strategies, which we do all the time in critical care pre-COVID, trying to prevent excess stretch of the lung and making sure that they don't build up too much fluid. Next slide. And that even as they get sicker, these are not particularly subspecialized interventions. prone positioning where you place someone on their stomach instead of on their back has been shown to have a marked improvement in outcomes in ARDS. And then we sometimes use neuromuscular blockade or paralytic agents to relax the muscles of patients on the breathing machine. But again, these are things that we have studied time and time again in ARDS that we know improve outcomes. Both low tidal volume ventilation, where we try to minimize stretch of the lungs, and prone positioning, both of which have those asterisks, they have been replicated in multiple studies as having a very significant mortality benefit. And I would emphasize that these do not require special equipment, and these are strategies that are employed routinely across many hospitals, even pre-COVID. And I think that's really good news because it means we can offer standard of care to these COVID-19 patients who are critically ill without having to expand our practice significantly. Advance, please. I will say that there are a subset of patients who have the most severe ARDS in whom we think about using ECMO, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, where we circulate the blood flow outside of the body to oxygenate the blood and essentially replace the function of the lungs. This is what I would consider to be a truly subspecialized therapy, where we know that outcomes are best when this is performed at institutions that have a lot of experience, and in which patients can become very complex to manage very quickly. This is a great opportunity for us to collaborate regionally to ensure that we identify the patients who may need this therapy and then transfer them to a capable center. But again, most of this evidence-based care for patients with ARDS is something that can be done in any hospital. Next slide. I think I've said all of that, so we'll say next slide. There has been a lot of enthusiasm in the media and also among scientific and clinical investigation circles around trying to modify the immune system of patients with COVID-19. We know that when patients get SARS-CoV-2 and develop COVID-19, that they can become very inflamed, just as patients who get influenza or another type of pneumonia can become inflamed. And so there's been a lot of interest in trying to suppress the inflammation and suppress the immune system or the immune reaction of patients who have COVID-19 in the hope that they can prevent some of the adverse outcomes of dysregulated inflammation. What's complicated about this, and I put this slide up not because I expect anyone, even the clinicians on the line, to want to see all of this, but this is a slide that describes the competing pathways in sepsis, which is an inflammatory condition that results from infection and which many patients with COVID-19 have. And on the top part of this slide in the red, those are all of the pathways of excessive inflammation that can cause tissue injury, cause other organs to fail, and can contribute to the pneumonia syndrome. On the bottom half of the slide is all of the immunosuppression that can occur at the same time in these patients. And one of the really complex things is deciding where to intervene. Advance, please. And one of the therapies I'm going to talk about today is tocilizumab, which has been much in the news. And tocilizumab is an anti-IL-6 mediator. It's a medication that suppresses a specific inflammatory mediator called IL-6. And I've highlighted on this very complex slide where this drug acts. It really acts in this hyperinflammatory portion of the response to infection. And I think most people can appreciate looking at this slide that targeting a single step in this very complex milieu of too much inflammation and too little inflammation may or may not be beneficial. And as I show you some of the data about how tocilizumab has not been as effective as we hoped, I think hopefully this slide puts that into context because the immune response to infection is just so complex. I put anakinra on this slide, not because I'm going to present data on this, because we don't have a lot of great data yet, but it's the other drug that has been widely discussed for COVID-19 and that some trials are looking at. Next slide. So as I said, tocilizumab is an anti-IL-6 drug. It's previously been on the market, so it's not a new drug for COVID-19, but it's a new application. And I'm going to highlight some of the data that have come out about tocilizumab. We know that some institutions have been, or at least at the beginning of the first wave in the Northeast, were using tocilizumab in many patients. And we have here a study that looks retrospectively at a large group of patients. You can see at the bottom of the slide that it's a total of almost 4,000 patients, and compares the patients who receive tocilizumab versus those who do not. This was not a randomized study, so patients weren't assigned to other groups, and it was not a blinded study, so every clinician who took care of these patients knew who had received tocilizumab and knew who did not. And this is a study that came out just this past month that showed that in this, again, retrospective but large cohort, getting tocilizumab was associated with a lower mortality. And you can see here the tocilizumab group in the yellow, overall fewer patients died in that group than they did in the no tocilizumab group. However, because this was not a study where patients were assigned to one of those two groups, and because the decision to give tocilizumab to a patient may have been influenced by a lot of factors that are hard to adjust for in retrospect, there's a lot of concern that this data may be confounded, and we call this confounded by indication. So I think this is intriguing but not conclusive that tocilizumab may be helpful. Next slide. Here's a study that came out in the very same issue of JAMA that did randomize patients. So this took patients who had COVID-19 pneumonia and randomized them to either receive tocilizumab or no tocilizumab, and otherwise they received the same care. And you can see here that overall, the patients who received tocilizumab in this study were less likely to require a mechanical ventilator, but there was no impact on mortality. I think for those of us in disaster preparedness, this is intriguing because, as was mentioned during the introductions, the number of ventilators available and the number of ICU beds available is something that is always under discussion and always of concern, even now that we've had some more time to prepare to care for these patients. However, whenever you see a disconnect between, for example, the likelihood that you need mechanical ventilation and the likelihood that someone survives, it raises the question of whether this study is just underpowered or if the difference in mechanical ventilation was by chance and not a real effect. So I think the size of the study is a little concerning. Next slide. Here's another study that randomized patients to either tocilizumab or standard care with COVID pneumonia, and this found no difference in either mechanical ventilation or in hospital discharge rates, the survival to discharge, absolutely no difference. Notably, this is exactly the same size as the trial on the prior slide. It came out in the same issue of JAMA, and it contradicts the prior slide. Next slide. And then this is the largest study that we have so far. This is a study that PI John Stone is here at MGH with Dr. Benninger, Dr. Letourneau, and I. This is the largest study we have. It took 243 patients and, again, randomized them to either receive the tocilizumab or to receive regular care but no tocilizumab, and, again, found no change. And so I think when we think about tocilizumab, next slide, the bottom line is that the immune response to COVID-19 is very complex. And the body needs some inflammation to fight infection and also may already have some immunosuppression or dysfunction of the immune system. And so giving a drug that targets one element of those very complex pathways may not be effective. And in fact, I would say that trial data available to date really do not support the use of tocilizumab. There are some conflicting data out there, but except in the context of a clinical trial, I personally would not recommend using tocilizumab routinely for your COVID-19 patients. There may be some subgroups of patients who will benefit, but we haven't yet identified them. And unfortunately, I think although all of us are hopeful we'll find new therapies, this is one that has not really proven to be a magic bullet yet. Next slide. The other drug I want to talk about is dexamethasone. So dexamethasone is a generic steroid. It's a cheap, widely available drug. We have studied steroids in non-COVID-19 respiratory failure and in other types of critical illness like septic shock, where dysregulated immune response to infection causes multiple organs in the body to fail. And I would say these have resulted in decidedly mixed results. We have some very positive studies in the literature, some resoundingly negative studies in the literature, and I think if you put 10 intensivists in a room, you'd get 12 opinions about when and where to use steroids. So I will just caveat this with saying that this is hotly contested even before COVID came along. We also know that steroids are very pleiotropic and that in addition to offering some very nonspecific immunosuppression, they can provide some other support to the body in sort of replacing the function of the adrenal glands, which can be suppressed in critical illness. And so even though the immunosuppression may not be universally beneficial, maybe they help in other ways. However, the mechanism is very, very poorly understood. I think on the plus side for dexamethasone, and I'll get to this again in a couple of minutes, we know from many studies in critically ill patients that you can give steroids to a critically ill patient and it seems to be safe, meaning we have not seen a lot of signal for harm in prior studies. Next slide. So with all of that said, sorry for the lengthy introduction, the RECOVERY trial came out in the New England Journal over the summer in COVID-19. Now, this is a very large study that dwarfs any prior study of steroids in ARDS pre-COVID. And they assigned 6,400 patients to either receive usual care or dexamethasone. It was a 1-to-2 ratio, so one patient who got dexamethasone, there was always two patients who got usual care. And when I say large and pragmatic, what that means is that it was not blinded. Everybody who was taking care of these patients knew what they were getting. It also means that they may have simultaneously been assigned to other therapeutic interventions that were being trialed. So you could be in the trial and receive multiple different trial interventions. But the recovery trial just looked at the effect of dexamethasone. And what you can see if you look at the upper left-hand panel A is that when you look at usual care versus dexamethasone, the dexamethasone group had a lower mortality. The steroid group had a lower mortality than the usual care group. On the right-hand upper panel in panel B, you can see that that difference in outcome was really exaggerated in patients who were on breathing machine, who were on invasive mechanical ventilation, and that the impact of dexamethasone or the association of dexamethasone with reducing mortality was much more exaggerated. Whereas if you look in panel D, so the bottom right-hand corner, you can see that the dexamethasone group actually trended toward having worse outcomes than the usual care group. And the y-axis for all of these is mortality. And so what I would say as a conclusion from this is that from this study is that the benefit is really focused in patients who require oxygen and maybe most beneficial in patients with mechanical ventilation, and that it should probably be avoided based on this trial data alone in patients who do not need supplemental oxygen, who don't have a severe pneumonia. Next slide. So we are routinely giving this in our patients who are critically ill here at MGH, and I think it's being given pretty widely. It really helps that this is a drug and a class of drugs that we have an extensive experience with in critically ill patients, and that it's reassuring from a safety perspective that we have used it for decades in critically ill patients and not seen a signal for harm. It's also generic, cheap, and widely available, which doesn't hurt. And I will say that although there may be a subgroup of patients who are harmed by steroids, we have not yet identified that. I think the signal for harm in the recovery trial is concerning, but not consistent with what we've seen in other critical illness trials and probably needs to be further explored. And we are still, I think, trying to sort out, if you have multiple therapeutic interventions available, what the interaction between dexamethasone and, for example, some of the therapies that Dr. Letourneau is about to speak about might be. There is no large, blinded, randomized trial, which we consider to be the gold standard for clinical evidence, where patients are assigned to one group or another, but we don't know which one they've received. We don't have that trial yet, and it may not be feasible to accomplish at this point, but I think if we see a trend in difference in outcomes in patients with COVID-19 who are critically ill in the coming months compared to how they did in April and March, and if we're able to adjust for all of those other contributions to how outcomes are changing, I would think that dexamethasone may be a major contributor to that. So we're very lucky that the best drug that we've found so far for patients who are this sick is something that's so widely available and so well known. I wish we had more to offer, but that's sort of where we are right now. And I will pass it over to Dr. Letourneau to take us through some of the other therapeutic interventions available.
Thanks. Thank you for having us. I'm happy to be here. So just to summarize a little bit of what Dr. Hibbert was talking about in terms of what we see and what seems to help, this is just a nice graphic sort of showing the trajectory of how patients sort of progress through their COVID-19 when they become acutely ill and become hospitalized, where we believe there's this incubation period in the beginning where typically they don't have any symptoms, they develop symptoms, sort of following the yellow and blue boxes in the middle here, over 5 to 10 days, and consider that sort of a mild phase, and then sort of become more acutely ill, potentially needing oxygen, and that's where they're coming into the hospital. And sort of what we think about is that in the beginning, it's much more of the virus that's causing a problem, and that the viral replication and the virus sort of taking hold is what's going on in the early phase, and potentially in the sort of 5 to 10 day range, and that beyond that, it's more of this inflammation that Dr. Hibbert was talking about, where the dexamethasone and the steroids may be helpful. And the reason I bring this up is that a lot of the therapies that we are exploring and that have come to sort of fruition through emergency use authorization and now FDA approval, you know, have some of these cutoffs in terms of where we think they help and potentially don't help. And we're still trying to figure that out and figuring out who the sort of specific patient population is that could benefit. So there are many patients who will just have mild disease and remain outpatients where they, you know, have fevers and myalgias and sort of feel tired and just feel unwell. And then typically when they're coming into the hospital, some of them won't be on oxygen and actually will do fine and just need a little help in terms of care in terms of fluids, because some of them will come in with diarrhea and some nausea and not eating well, but the ones who end up on oxygen where some of our therapeutics might be helpful. Next slide. So the big drug that everybody's probably heard of is this drug remdesivir. It's an antiviral. So this was initially approved for emergency use authorization in May, at the beginning of May, and just received FDA approval a couple of weeks ago. Now, this was a drug that was initially developed actually for other viruses and actually was studied in Ebola, but never got approved because the trials just never fully enrolled and it was unclear whether it was helpful. And so this was an initial early drug that they started to study. The NIH put together a nice adaptive trial that was a randomized controlled trial looking at patients getting remdesivir versus placebo. So the ideal trial that we look for, we were one of the sites actually that enrolled in that trial, and they were able to very quickly get data by mid-April in terms of being able to enroll people and show that remdesivir could be somewhat helpful for certain patient populations. The things that we think about is that patients who have liver dysfunction, which we can see in and of itself with this coronavirus, with COVID-19, it should be avoided in, although we haven't had any patients who have had liver function tests. We have not had many patients that have had liver function tests that have been so out of the norm that we couldn't give it to them. And then patients who have kidney dysfunction, which as well we can see with COVID-19, it can affect the kidneys. It's sort of the other patient population we don't tend to give it in. And this is just a picture of the structure. Next slide. So as of now, so as of earlier this week, the best results we have are from this NIH trial that I had mentioned. It's called the ACT-1 trial. There are multiple trials after that comparing remdesivir with additional therapeutics to see if we can boost sort of its effect. But what the thing that we really saw, and people debate how significant this is in terms of clinical significance for patients admitted to the hospital, is that there's a certain patient population, which is basically the patients who were admitted and were on oxygen, and were just on oxygen, not mechanically ventilated like Dr. Hibbert was talking about, where steroids benefit, but patients who were on the floors on oxygen, that they improved more quickly. So they improved more quickly compared to people who got placebo. So their improvement was about 4 days, so 11 days improvement with the remdesivir versus 15 days with the placebo. It looks like potentially they may have had a mortality benefit, so patients who got remdesivir potentially were less likely to die, although the study was not powered. There weren't enough patients to sort of say that was statistically significant. But again, it's really this small patient population of patients who were on oxygen. Patients, there have been other trials that have looked at patients not on oxygen, and there may be a benefit there, but again, it's not completely clear. And then it seems that the patients who are already mechanically ventilated or who are invasive ventilation, so BiPAP or CPAP, which are these other devices that can be used, that those patients may not benefit as much from the remdesivir. So again, these are data that the trials are not as large as we would like them to be able to sort of say specifically that this is where they benefit. But the FDA, there was enough data to suggest to the FDA that this would be approved to be able to decrease sort of the length of symptoms and hopefully get patients out of the hospital sooner when they come in. There's a large trial called the Solidarity Trial, which is very similar to the recovery trial that Dr. Hibbert was talking about, which was a large open-label trial across multiple countries that is showing that for mortality, so seeing if we can improve decreased death rates, that remdesivir actually does nothing. But there are issues with sort of the patient population and not delineating quite as well in terms of which patients were on oxygen and how much oxygen to go with that. Those data are not peer-reviewed yet. They've just been released so that we can review them, although they have not been peer-reviewed and published. So as of now, I would say in terms of an antiviral, remdesivir is the drug that is being used and is officially approved. Next slide. These are the FDA indications. So it's treatment of COVID-19 or people with suspected COVID-19 admitted to the hospital. All adult patients would qualify. And then pediatric patients, it's those that are 12 years of age or older and actually over 3.5 kilos and weigh at least 40 kilos. Sorry, for the FDA indications, it's pediatric patients who are 12 years of age and at least 40 kilos. It has to be administered in the hospital. This is not an outpatient administration. Patients need to be in inpatient care, and things that we check and follow are the kidney function, the liver function, and the prothrombin time, which is new. That was added onto the FDA package insert. And these are all labs that people typically get as they're coming into the hospital. Next slide. The dosing is there, so it's usually a 5-day course with a load on the first day. Again, this is for 5 days. It's typically patients who are just on oxygen. If the decision is made to give to patients who are in invasive ventilation or mechanical ventilation or on ECMO, then it can be considered to go to 10 days, although it's unclear that 10 days really does much more than 5 days based on some preliminary data that we have. And in patients who come in and get started and are feeling better at day 3, they can be discharged home. There's no reason that they need to stay in the hospital to receive the rest of the drug, and that is how all of the trials and all of the studies with remdesivir have been done. So it's nice that some patients actually turn around quickly, whether from the drug or not, and are able to go home before finishing this. In patients who have low kidney function, the package insert from the FDA really says that it should not be used, but it's not recommended, but this is where potentially a risk-benefit discussion with the patients can be had, and that's what we typically do here. The reason for that is that the carrier, so what remdesivir is mixed with in order to infuse it, has a component called cyclodextrin, which can accumulate and cause kidney dysfunction. We have not had any issues with that in terms of being able to give that to patients or have kidney dysfunction. If we have, you stop the drug and typically everything is okay. So this is just something that we follow, and we have very comfortably given this to patients whose kidney function is slightly lower when it's clear that they may benefit from the drug. There are some side effects. Some patients will have an infusion reaction where they feel flushing and get tingly. And so that is something to watch out for. It's very rare. And then we follow the liver tests and the kidneys. Next slide. These are the NIH guidelines, which are a little narrower than the FDA recommendation. Part of this is just trying to meld together all of the data that we have thus far and trying to maximize who we think remdesivir benefits the most, based on the data that are available to us. And part of this also, when thinking about it, is initially there were supply issues with remdesivir. Now it seems the supply issues are less of a problem, but the cost of remdesivir can be an issue. It's about $3,200 for the 5-day course. And so that is a significant cost for hospitals and for patients, and sort of thinking about really who are the patients that benefit the most, that is something that has been taken into consideration. So here, and there's the link there for people to follow up on, but basically that patients who are hospitalized and are on oxygen, it's recommended that we give them remdesivir, which is what we're doing at our facility. And then those patients who are on potentially higher levels of oxygen, adding on dexamethasone, the steroid makes sense. As Dr. Hibbert mentioned, we haven't studied these two interventions together, so there's some debate as to whether they actually will be helpful together. There are some data to suggest remdesivir is much better in the early phase where the virus is replicating, so sort of before the 7 to 10 day mark of symptoms, and that dexamethasone is better beyond that. But again, we don't have the nitty-gritty data as of now to sort of to be able to say that for sure, but that is sort of the biological plausibility of that. Next slide. This is just the rest of those that are hospitalized and require oxygen sort of through these high flow devices or non-invasive ventilation or ventilation, that really the dexamethasone really is key for those patients, and adding on the remdesivir as well, even though we're not as sure that that's as helpful in that patient population. Next slide. And to add on, dexamethasone is a cheap drug, which I think Dr. Hibbert had mentioned, which is nice when you're thinking about having to treat large populations and being able to do that in the healthcare system that we are in. Remdesivir is still available for emergency use authorization for kids. So as I mentioned, so it's 12 years and older, as well as 40 kilos. And then for everybody else who's younger than that, we can still give it through an emergency use authorization. This did not get FDA approval for kids because it hasn't been studied extensively in kids. It's a relatively safe drug, and we've felt comfortable giving that to them. The issue with emergency use authorization, which I'll talk about in a few minutes as well, is that there needs to be assent from the family. So you need to talk to families about this and discuss the risks and benefits. They need to be given an information sheet that is required by the FDA and requires documentation. It's a little bit more cumbersome for hospitals to do this. We did this initially with remdesivir as well, but there can be sometimes communication issues with families, and so making sure that those documents are available in the native language for the patients, because the language is also kind of dire because of the legalese that needs to be on there, meaning that there's a sentence on there that remdesivir may cause you to die or you may not die whether or not you take this, and so it can be a little taken aback for patients when they're seeing this. Next slide. So moving on from remdesivir, so the big story in the news more recently has been these monoclonal antibodies. So basically, these are antibodies that have been developed to help block sort of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the virus that causes COVID, to get into the cells and cause infection. So there's a specific protein that we can block that has been developed by a couple different drug companies to be able to block that and hopefully help patients not get infected, essentially block the entry from the virus into the cell and cause further disease. So the two sort of main ones that have been discussed most broadly are the Lilly product and the Regeneron product, which don't have names yet. They just have these long numbers and letters put together. But essentially the thought process is that you can give this drug, it blocks sort of the ability for the virus to get into the cell, and therefore patients can feel better sooner. It's sort of a passive protection, and so the thought process is that these things don't work sort of as soon as patients, once patients are hospitalized, these are no longer useful because the virus has already taken hold and sort of need to be given early on in the course of disease. The Lilly product is one monoclonal, and the Regeneron product is sort of a cocktail, meaning it's multiple monoclonals together. The Lilly is actually coming out with one that's combined as well. Next slide. So for the Lilly data, there was an article published in the New England Journal of Medicine last week, which shows some phase two preliminary data. Again, this was all done in outpatients, and basically they were able to show that one of the doses decreased the viral load by day 11 compared to those who were getting a placebo infusion. They combined sort of emergency department visits and hospital admissions into one and looked to see how many patients had to have an ED visit or hospital admission in the 29 days after receiving the infusion. And it did show that patients who got the infusion had fewer visits than those who did not. Again, these are very small numbers, but it was 1.6% versus 6.3%. And they did show, although, again, these are small numbers and they weren't powered to sort of say this for sure, but that high-risk patients, so patients 65 and older or who have a body mass index of 35 and over, had the greatest benefit. And if you sort of think about the numbers that Dr. Bittinger was showing at the beginning, we know that patients who are 65 and older have more hospitalizations, they have greater mortality, and we do know that patients who have a higher BMI also have greater mortality from this disease. So potentially a great product that could potentially decrease hospitalizations for our highest-risk patients. It was pretty well tolerated. Most patients had some nausea as their main complaint, but that was the most common adverse reaction. Again, these can cause some infusion-related reactions, and it's something that needs to keep in mind if we are going to implement this widely. Next slide. The Regeneron data, we don't have anything published in terms of the paper yet. It was just a press release that showed in the phase two and three trials, again, in outpatients, reduced the viral load and reduced medical visits compared to a placebo by a decent amount. And again, sort of showing them the best benefit in those who had the higher viral load. which makes sense. If you have a high viral load, you're more likely to get sicker, and if you can block that, that is helpful. People who had the pre-existing factors similar to age and BMI or had a weak antibody response. So basically, they measured how much antibody, so how much the own body was producing of its fighting proteins, and if that was low, then they benefited most from being given these monoclonal antibodies. Again, infusion reactions were sort of the adverse events that they could see. Next slide. The inpatient, so they have tried these in inpatient trials as well. All of those have been halted due to safety concerns, some adverse reactions, as well as showing that it's really not helpful at that point. And again, this is the thought process that many times once the patients are coming into the hospital and admitted, the virus is less of an, the active virus is less of an issue, and it's much more the inflammatory phase of the body that's taken over, where these other drugs might be helpful, like steroids. Next slide. So for the monoclonal antibodies, so none of these have been approved. There's word out on the street that potentially they will get this an emergency use authorization as well. And again, they bind the virus and they try to help the immune response against COVID-19. They're probably helpful earlier in disease, so these would be infusions that would have to happen in the outpatient setting and not necessarily, and is not helpful for patients in the hospital. But sort of thinking about if these do become part of therapy, that this will be something that needs to be done in an outpatient monitored setting, and sort of thinking about how to implement this is sort of some of the things that we're doing right now if this does come to fruition in terms of being a product that we will be giving to our patients. Next slide. This is just the information about an emergency use authorization. You know, this is basically that, you know, it hasn't gone through full FDA approval, but is being used because of the emergency of COVID-19, and that you do need to assent patients. We don't need written consent, but you do need to discuss, as I said, these information sheets, which sometimes can be a problem with some of the language barriers that come up with some of our patient populations that are highest hit. Next slide. I think I'm coming to the end. Just a few words about vaccines. There are multiple vaccines in phase 3 trials in the U.S. and abroad. There are several different platforms that they're trying to use so that there are different, the companies are studying different vaccine types to see if there's a way to overcome sort of the way that COVID-19 infects us. There are inactivated vaccines, live attenuated protein subunit vaccines, and then these other DNA-based and RNA-based strategies, which are on the newer side, and I just gave examples of some of the vaccines that are there. But again, we need more data. You know, these trials are enrolling 30,000 to 60,000 patients to see if there's some benefit and to be sure that there's safety there. So I think that's all I have to say. I think I have one more slide on vaccines. Next slide. Again, we just need to wait for the data. There may be this emergency use authorization as well for the vaccines, which again may be a little difficult to implement, needing assent and such for that, and we'll need to sort of prioritize the recipients given the fact that we think there'll be a limited supply to start off with, and I put in the playbooks that's available online for that from the CDC. Next slide. And I think that's it. Perfect.
So let me say thank you so, so very much to Dr. Hibbert, Dr. Letourneau for such amazing presentations. Certainly I'm aware that so many of you are deeply involved in vaccine planning, and many of you have started paying an awful lot of attention to the monoclonal antibody therapies as well because of some of the information that's out there right now. I do see that there's a question in the Q&A about how much time the infusions require. We don't know for sure, of course, what the emergency use authorization might say, but if we look at what has been in the treatment protocols so far, the research protocols, they've required an hour or more to infuse the medication, as well as an hour of observation afterwards. So certainly not a small endeavor to get patients with mild or moderate illness who are outpatients to an infusion site to do the hours infusion, to do the hours watch. I think we're watching so closely to see the potential benefits and what the future data will show about those therapies.
One other thing with the monoclonals as well, at least the way that the studies were done, was that really it was within patients presented, they had their swab done, and within sort of 3 to 4 days, they were started on the infusion. So this is very early on in disease, and this is another thing that we are trying to think of as an institution, if there's an EUA that there's a difference among populations of when they get tested for COVID. So some patient populations, you know, they have one sniffle, they come in, they're tested, versus some of our vulnerable populations who are not necessarily in the medical system, who may wait, you know, day five, day six to get their swab, and it's unclear that the monoclonals will be helpful for them at that point. And so there's still a lot of questions out there in terms of which patients benefit the most and how can we be sure that we're able to give these to the patients who would benefit the most in an equitable fashion.
Great point. Either for Alyssa or Catherine, there's a question, are you aware of any potential intramuscular formulations for the monoclonal antibody products?
I think one of them is looking to do an intramuscular or subcutaneous infusion, which would obviously be much easier to do, which is the way a lot of other monoclonals are given. So it would be nice as opposed to having to place an IV and such.
Yeah, I will say that we are one of the sites for the Active 3 platform trial that's looking at monoclonals, and none of the initial candidate drugs are intramuscular, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was going to be an effort, as Alyssa said.
Excellent. And just to come back to a point that Alyssa had made, I think what we think we know about the indication, the timing of monoclonals is that testing people early in their illness, getting the result of that test, and then getting people when they're eligible to an appropriate infusion site is actually going to be a tight ballet that we're going to have to try and coordinate across the public health and medical systems to be able to reach patients if that's indeed what ends up being proved by the data. So yet another, I think, logistical challenge as we're working on vaccines and ongoing response otherwise. So I think we're going to stop here. We're just about to the hour. This webinar has been recorded, and we will be posting the recording on our website, which you can see here is rdhrs.org. I would so much like to thank Gary and Russ from ASPR and FEMA. Really, really want to thank Dr. Letourneau, Dr. Hibbert for their contributions, for their amazing lectures. Please don't hesitate to reach out to us on our website if there are additional webinar topics that you think will be helpful, other resources that you think we can be of use to provide for you. But want to thank you, everyone who's attended, for your hard work in supporting the response so far. Wish you all the very best for the weekend, and take care. Thanks.